About the tools scientists use to investigate the human brain, explore a mission to understand the Earth's aurora, and find out how to extract DNA from everyone's favorite vegetable. But first, a major border crossing becomes a field test for sensor networks, all on this edition of On Beyond.
Crossing the Rio Grande River at Eagle Pass, Texas, the Camino Real International Bridge is emerging as a critical commercial thoroughfare between the U.S. and Mexico and a potential target for border crime. Now a team of nearly a dozen UC San Diego researchers have successfully deployed a prototype high-tech video surveillance system to help police in the tiny town of Eagle Pass monitor vehicular and human traffic under and around the busy toll bridge.
The first time I heard about the need at Eagle Pass was in February 2005.
Less than 18 months later, UCSD electrical engineering professor Mohan Trivedi joined Eagle Pass Mayor Chad Foster and other officials at a news conference in Texas to unveil the prototype system called Eagle Eyes, the first of its kind in operation.
It provides 24/7 surveillance of 360 degrees. And again, one of the concerns that we all have on the border is homeland security. And this is a project that will better facilitate the overview and underview of our commercial bridge should there be any activities.
It is really an experimental test bed for doing more research also, but it is an operational, useful system for people to use it from today onwards.
Eagle Pass has been highlighted for many years as a major crossing point for illegal trafficking of narcotics and human traffic, and we want to make this particular area of Texas a safe haven for our citizens. And certainly national security is an issue of great concern for us.
One of our greatest concerns was of what can happen under this bridge. Border Patrol is doing a tremendous job, but this will just add an additional facet to help protect Eagle Pass and the border.
The Eagle Eye system grew out of work Trivedi and his computer vision and robotics research group were doing at UCSD in the wake of 9/11. They are among the first to adapt machine vision technologies for counterterrorism surveillance with funding from the Federal Interagency Technical Support Working Group, TISWG for short.
After the 9/11 tragedy, TISWG was given a lot of Department of Defense money to try to look at some innovative technologies from the non-big DOD type applications. And we published a broad agency announcement and received thousands of good ideas.
More than 12,500 applications were submitted in response to that first call for proposals. Only 47 were funded in that first round, and the UC San Diego project was one of only 8 in the area of surveillance technology.
In surveillance, a lot of times we're talking about surveillance of individuals that may not know that they're being looked at for some type of reason. In our physical security group, we do more the type of programs that we're talking about here, where we're looking at a high threat area or a secure area that we want to provide some kind of protection to.
Trivedi says these are full-fledged systems.
Camera is a part of it. Computers is another part of it. Communication, how do you take things to cooperate between themselves or cooperate with an operator which is half a mile away or half a world apart? And then how much of involvement of a human operator is required to look at all these cameras is also a research issue.
Trivedi's work later caught the attention of Chris Aldridge, director of a National Institute of Justice program called the Border Research and Technology Center, based in San Diego. Aldridge was looking for solutions to Eagle Pass's bridge surveillance challenge. That challenge, existing border cameras provided coverage of the bridge's surface, leaving large areas below and near the bridge uncovered.
The problem that Eagle Pass identified was the need to obtain some type of a picture of what was going on underneath the bridges that went across the Rio Grande River. So there had to be an innovative solution identified and applied, and that again led us to Dr. Trivedi's work and his project in using 360 degrees video surveillance in the context of some other camera configurations to give them that sort of public safety picture that they really needed.
That technology is one of the critical components integrated into the Eagle Eye system, which includes three cameras distributed underneath the Camino Real Bridge.
So that you can see actually an antenna which is shooting the video stream all the way to the receiving station there.
On the riverside near Mexico, a pan-tilt zoom camera is equipped with near-infrared illuminators, providing high-resolution 24/7 surveillance of dimly lit regions, even in the pitch darkness of night. 400 feet away, roadside, an omnidirectional 360-degree camera provides a panoramic view of the entire bridge as well as nearby roads and riverbanks, and another pan-tilt zoom camera is integrated in the system that allows event-driven servoing. Servoing is a well-established robot control technique using vision in feedback control loops, and an anomalous event perceived on the OmniVision camera can then trigger a move by the companion camera to pan-tilt or zoom in on an area where the event appears to be happening for a clearer close-up picture.
The unique factors that we have that we're really pushing for is automated analysis of the data. So the Border Patrol has a lot of cameras, but they're all still viewing it themselves. We're offering computer vision algorithms to actually detect events so we don't have to have people looking at every single screen coming.
It is like human beings that the panoramic vision is providing us peripheral vision. But then if you want to home in on something which is interesting at certain spot, then the foveated vision, so to say, can be realized by this pan-tilt zoom controllable camera. So that unisom operation, how do you make it work, has been one of the research areas that we do.
Eagle Eyes runs with Trivedi's custom software, which helps capture, analyze, encrypt, transmit, and display video. All three cameras stream video simultaneously to a control room in the nearby Eagle Pass Customs building via both secure wireless connections and wired landlines.
We thought about what may happen if there is a failure of some kind of a wire transmission. Then it had wireless, high bandwidth, very secure wireless communication, and vice versa. So we can actually choose which particular communication capability that you would like to use.
So it's a redundant system. We'll be able to monitor this whole area here. And this area is really going to expand out in the next decade or so. There's going to be a lot of traffic going through, so the city really wants to make sure this area is secure and protected.
Police interact with the video through an intuitive map-based user interface. They can control the cameras and use a joystick to focus on objects of interest.
If I'm seeing some activity under the bridge, I can zoom in on some license plates on a car, or I can zoom in on a person face, and I can get a still image of it. That's going to let us know of activity that's happening on the bridge, whereas we don't have to send anybody just to patrol or depend on somebody to call us. We can see it in time, and at the same time, with the still images that we can photograph, that's going to help us to provide evidence in case we do catch somebody.
I'm very excited, first of all, that we can enhance, you know, our visibility of what is actually happening on the other side, on the Mexican side, and capture, like for instance, highlighting the license plates of vehicles. We were concerned also of vehicles parking underneath the bridge and waiting for a load of illegals or narcotics, you know, and dumping them, and then those vehicles leaving the scene out into the county. Now we'll be able to capture the image of the license plates and the vehicles, and maybe even the face of the driver or the occupants or the people that took the narcotics or brought the human trafficking.
Because these are distributed cameras, like human binocular eyes are distributed, the advantage is that if we can get them calibrated and triangulated properly, then we can actually realize the depth perspective also.
Now that the UCSD team has deployed the first generation of Eagle Eyes, they are busy in their California lab working on next steps, including automatic 24/7 situational awareness of a scene.
That there's so many events that will be happening during the daytime, nighttime, and in so many locations that we can't possibly cover them all with people watching the cameras and controlling it themselves. So we want the machine to be able to learn what events that are going on in the scene are the abnormal and dangerous events and try to identify those events. And this is the sort of research that's moving forward from the Eagle Eyes project.
I'd like to see more pilot projects in other areas, you know, that apply this technology to solving real problems out there in the security area.
The work on Eagle Eyes was funded by TISWIG with supplemental funding from the Department of Homeland Security. The National Science Foundation is funding UCSD's Trivedi to work on related technologies. The RESCUE project, for instance, led by the California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology, is investigating the use of Eagle Eyes-type systems to support enhanced situational awareness for first responders in the wake of an emergency or natural disaster. A two-camera version was deployed in late August during a San Diego County disaster preparedness exercise at UCSD.
Robustness to environmental conditions, so it goes 24/7 and long-term, was one of the defining criteria in this particular project. And the second one was ability to scale up. So we really believe that the way this is structured, where we have got wireless connectivity as well as wired connectivity, allows us to really, on hours' notices, start adding additional nodes.
I think that you saw a great chemistry there of trust and performance that emerged between the university team and between the law, not only the chief of police office, but also the whole city of Eagle Pass and the municipality there as well.
I think this is one of the few, if not the only, testbed where a university has actually deployed it to a real security environment, you know, outdoors. You've seen the wiring, the applications, the redundancy they had to put in. That's a great success story, not only for the university, but for the way the government's worked, the way we use the taxpayers' funds. And, you know, I hope that UCSD will continue to be interested in this kind of work.
I personally would like to see this thing stay in place for a few years. So it allows us a very unique opportunity to observe with this distributed interactive video arrays real-world conditions in something which is of national, international, local significance.
This is Doug Ramsey in San Diego.
Like many scientists, neuroscientists try to devise experiments to understand how the brain works. And in my case, our interest is in trying to understand how the brain develops at early stages of embryonic development. It's almost magical because the brain self-assembles. It puts itself together. There's no one in there doing it for us. It self-assembles at very early stages. And it's been wonderful to understand that there's actually an orderly process going on here. The first stage of this involves proliferation of neurons to generate massive numbers of cells. This is followed by a period of migration when the cells move to their final locations to take up their final dwelling places. And then there's an extended period of differentiation when the neurons acquire the functions that they will play in the adult brain. So we now have some understanding of how this process occurs in general, and we are doing experiments to try to figure out how these processes are regulated during development. It's difficult to work on the human brain for several reasons. First of all, it develops in the uterus when the embryo is developing, and as a consequence, it's not very easily accessible at the early stages of development. And then on top of all that, it develops rather slowly over a period of months. So we've chosen to work on what's called popularly in science a model system, the frog nervous system. And this is quite attractive because the fertilization of the eggs occurs externally, typically in pond water. Here, of course, we do it artificially in the lab. And then the embryos are accessible throughout the entire period of development as a consequence. In addition, the maturation of the embryos is quite rapid, and the nervous system effectively is fully blown, fully developed within 24 hours after fertilization of the egg. So it's quite a rapid process. In biology generally, and neuroscience specifically, different model systems are best suited for the solution of particular problems. And so a whole variety of different species are in active use today, from fruit flies to nematode worms, zebrafish, frogs, which are our model, mice, rats, and so on. All of these have proven useful in different ways. There are different advantages and also disadvantages to each of these different model systems. Because biological systems are related to one another, the expectation is, and indeed the proof has been, that discoveries made in a model system are often generally applicable to the human condition. And so this is a benefit to working with a model system. It's implicit in the studies of development that if we understand how development normally occurs in the nervous system, then we can hope to be able to prevent disorders of development of the nervous system, a very important objective. And this is one of the goals of the National Institutes of Health that provides funding for our research and for the research of many other investigators. The development of particular tools have been crucial to scientific advances in all fields, and certainly neuroscience is no exception. The development of electron microscopy that became available in a major way in the 1960s really gave us enormous insights into the structure of neurons. In the 70s, techniques were developed for recording the electrical activity of single neurons. Again, very powerful, giving us an understanding of how individual nerve cells behave. With the development of fluorescent probes that one could use to tag particular proteins, look at the expression of particular genes, there was a real revolution in our ability to address scientific problems, understand how nerve cells develop and how they function in the mature nervous system. And most recently, in the 90s, the development of brain scan technologies have been terribly useful. Understanding in the intact animal and in the intact human being how our brains are acting while we are doing particular attacks and perceiving particular objects in our environment. These tools and others that are still to be developed will allow us to address questions, probably some of which we haven't even learned to ask at this point. Scientific problems become ripe for solution, just the way fruit becomes ripe for picking. And the development and practical use of new tools is an important aspect of this ripeness and readiness for solution of scientific problems. I have to say that it is tremendous fun and can be very exciting to be discovering something new that no one had known before. This is a deeply satisfying and very rewarding process.
The magnificent moves of the aurora, or northern lights. They can be seen over the far northern regions of the world and at the South Pole. And sometimes, the beautiful sheets of color move about the sky in wavy patterns or bursts of brightness. But besides sparking the awe and fascination of people lucky enough to see them, the celestial dances of the auroras have provoked a decades-long debate among scientists. Exactly how and where are they being triggered? The question has confounded space scientists for more than 30 years. The sun is continuously shooting off electrically charged gas called solar wind, which blows forcefully across the Earth. Some of the charged particles get caught in the magnetic field that surrounds the Earth, the magnetosphere, stretching it out like rubber bands and showing up as an aurora. Very strong solar winds cause space storms and stress the bands of the magnetosphere, triggering a sudden release of energy called a substorm, stirring the aurora into motion.
Okay, you can see a bit of aurora through the clouds at one of the sites.
UC Berkeley Space Sciences Laboratory is leading a NASA mission to finally understand how and where auroral substorms happen.
This choice of putting together a mission that will study this very focused goal was a combination of the field reaching that level of technical expertise and a nagging question that the field had to resolve.
Vasilis Angelopoulos is the principal investigator of the mission, which is called Themis, after the Greek goddess of justice. Justice in this case being the final ruling on where auroral substorms are triggered. Aside from greatly broadening our understanding of space, the new knowledge will also help scientists protect astronauts and spacecraft from getting hurt in violent space weather.
It is a fantastic opportunity for Berkeley, but it also is a tremendous responsibility. So it has been exhilarating, but also excruciating, but great fun.
As a collaboration among NASA, Berkeley, UCLA, and space science agencies and universities in Canada, France, Germany, and Austria, Themis is a new kind of space mission in many ways. It's a constellation mission, meaning several satellites will be launched together in one rocket and then released into separate but specifically designed orbits.
The Themis satellites are designed to be placed strategically along the Sun-Earth line and track the flow of energy from one to the other, very much like meteorologists use buoys out in the ocean to track large ocean waves as they move from one buoy to the other in order to understand the flow of atmospheric energy.
Berkeley built the instruments for the five satellites at the same time, also a first, and will be controlling the route and choreography of the spacecraft throughout the mission.
Everybody says, you can't get five spacecraft done in that span of time, and we did it anyway. You know, we weren't making hot rods. We were making, we were making Tauruses, we were making Volkswagens. We knew what we needed, what they needed to be able to do, and so we built that in early, and we built it so that they were easy to manufacture, easy to put together, and easy to test.
Well, Themis has been challenging because we have five spacecraft to build. It's important that they all measure basically the same magnetic fields and electric fields and particles.
At a cost of $180 million over 3 years, it was a real achievement that the Themis project came in on time and on budget. NASA's Dave Seibeck says the investment on Themis has been well worth it.
This is absolutely the greatest thing that's happened. We're going to have all the information we need to address the questions that have been raised over the past 30 years.
One of the key ways the Themis satellites will answer the substorm question is through their long antennas, which detect electrical and magnetic fields during substorms.
And this is what's known as an axial boom. One shoots out the top, one shoots out the bottom. This thing deploys in about half a second.
To complement the satellites, scientists at the University of Calgary installed and operate 16 observatories in Canada. The stations are equipped with fisheye cameras and computers built by Berkeley that photograph and record information about the auroras passing over them. Berkeley runs several more stations in Alaska.
The dome protects the lens and the camera from the elements, and they have temperature control so that these little boxes can survive and take the data down and transmit some of the data back to us more or less in real time.
Themis also has a strong public education component directed by Berkeley's Center for Science Education. UCLA installed magnetometers on 13 remote rural school campuses in 10 states where the instruments can register changes in the Earth's magnetosphere free from interference from traffic. The Themis mission will be complete in 2 years, but if all goes well, the scientists here expect to redirect the satellites to explore other unanswered questions about space. At Berkeley's Space Science Laboratory, this is Roxanne Makashchin.
I'm Marty Yanofsky, and my laboratory here at UCSD is trying to understand the molecular details for how flowers develop. Now, the secret to understanding how flowers develop lies within the genetic information within every single cell. The genetic information, of course, is the DNA that carries basically the blueprint for how a flower will develop. Now, in order to understand how genetic information, or DNA, controls flower development, it's very useful to isolate or purify the DNA from cells. And today, for a demonstration, we're going to start with broccoli, a plant that I'm sure most of you love to eat almost every day, broccoli plant, and we're going to grind up the broccoli and purify the DNA away from all of the other parts of the cell. Now, it's a very simple procedure. You can do it in your classroom, and of course, you'll want to do it at home with your mom and dad. So we start with a broccoli plant, and all we do is we break it up into little pieces and put it into a blender. So I'm going to break it up, and it doesn't really matter how much you take. It can be about a cup. So the first step then, after adding the broccoli to the blender, is to add some water. Just pour in the water. And add a pinch of salt, just a little pinch. You can see it doesn't really take very much. And then don't forget to put on the lid. If you don't put on the lid, you know what might happen. Turn it on. That's all it really takes, about 10 seconds or so. And we've really ground up the broccoli into nice, tiny little pieces and have a liquid mush. And the next step is also very simple. We just need to get rid of some of the pieces of broccoli that haven't been broken up. So we're going to take this solution that we have, and we're going to pour it through a sieve of some kind, or in this case, some cheesecloth, and allow the liquid that contains the DNA, of course, as well as other things, to go through into the bottom. And in the very top, we'll trap all of this broccoli that we haven't quite ground up finely enough. So we still have the DNA in here, but we've got a lot of other things in there as well. And so the next step, which is also very simple, we need to add some soap, and any kind of detergent will do. In this case, I'm going to use this detergent and just squirt in a little bit, a couple tablespoons worth, like that. And also some meat tenderizer. What the meat tenderizer does is it degrades the proteins, and that will also help in the DNA isolation step. So again, doesn't matter exactly how much, just put in a little of that meat tenderizer. And then we simply need to stir it up. And what's happening now are the cells are getting broken open by the detergent and the meat tenderizer that we've added. To really maximize the DNA isolation, we'll let that go for about 10 minutes. And then we'll come back to it and do the final step, which is to add some alcohol. Okay, it's now been about 10 minutes. And what we're going to do is take this material that we have and pour it into this tube. Of course, you can just do this in a small glass at home. It really doesn't matter what you pour it into. And just pour about that amount in. And you can hold it up to the light, and you can see it's kind of a cloudy solution. And then what we need to do is take some rubbing alcohol, just standard rubbing alcohol that everybody has at home, and we're going to add the alcohol, again, very, very gently. Very gently, we're going to add the alcohol, so we don't want to mix the alcohol too much. We want it to end up on top of the plant cells that we've broken open. So you can see the clear alcohol still is up on top, and the plant cells that we've broken open are on the bottom, and then the DNA should be at the interface where the alcohol meets the plant cells. And so we can just very slowly and gently wind the DNA around in a circle, and those little tiny DNA fibers that are very long get tangled up with one another. And as they get tangled up with one another, they come out of the solution into the alcohol and allows us to very easily see them. And we can wind it up like that, right out in a very nice long piece of DNA, and we can lift it right out of solution, and we can see basically pure DNA that we've extracted from those broccoli cells. So here is the pure DNA, and in our laboratory we use this DNA to identify the pieces within this DNA that control the development of the different parts of the flower. And so we would ultimately go back to the flower and isolate the different genes or pieces of DNA that control the formation of these beautiful white petals. We'll be right back.